All right. Well, let me just say right now, I'm going to try and get an open line for you sometime this hour. They're filling up pretty fast, but we'll try and burn through the questions as quickly as we can with Sandra Blakeslee and her son Matthew, co-authors of "The Body Has a Mind of Its Own." It's all about body mapping, something, a process that the brain does all the time, which we're just really beginning to understand. In its full dimensions. I want to throw a question out to them before I go to the break while we're still lining up a couple of callers. Is because we were talking about that at the top of the hour about how a pilot would walk around his plane or her plane before getting in. And of course, part of that's just sort of a safety check, a visual check of what's going on with a plane. But I wonder whether there isn't also some sort of subconscious component of looking at what you're about to attach to your body map.
There could be, because pilots talk about that, absorbing the aircraft into their body. And it's a very, very common experience. So I suppose eyeballing it as you would give you a better sense of the map. But actually flying it is where you feel that sense. If you're just looking at it on the ground, you wouldn't absorb it in your body until you're actually piloting it.
Well, I wonder then whether there might be an interesting experiment of taking a pilot onto a plane without allowing the pilot to know what kind of plane, he or she is flying, and then get up in the air and then once it's in a safe place to do this, take up the blindfolded pilot and stick them in the cockpit and see if they can't tell the difference in the plane that they're flying. Can they tell how big it is? Or does the body map of the pilot absorb the size of the plane without seeing it, without being able to visualize what plane it is?
It's a very cool question. I don't know. You should try that. Maybe some pilots would call in and tell
Yeah.
us what they think. That would be
Okay. And
interesting.
after the plane crashes, they say, "This guy on the radio told me to do it blind." So, all right, we'll come back. We'll get all the questions next for Sandy and Matthew Blakeslee on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Well, every time I think about this subject, I think of new questions for Sandy and Matthew Blakeslee, but I'll hold on mine and let's go east to the Rockies where Karen is in Houston on Coast to Coast AM. Karen?
Yes, good morning.
Morning to you.
Well, I have a question. How many maps can the brain accommodate? People who have split personalities,
Oh,
their
that's a great
body
question.
might have, in one personality, some physical handicap, I guess you could say, or some kind of an illness like maybe diabetes, and this can be proven physically in exams. And then another personality might pop up, and they have no sign of diabetes in the body system.
Well, or even just if somebody had split personalities where one of them was a 6 foot male named Hugo and the other one was a 5 foot woman named Beatrice, and so well, yeah, exactly. Or for that matter, non-human personalities, which often happens in the multiple personality disorder. Very good question. All right, so Sandy or Matthew, anybody on that?
Wow, that's
Well,
interesting. I don't know if there's any research on that, but I mean, you have dozens, perhaps more, of these maps in your brain. And I'm sure the maps can have multiple, I guess you probably call them modes, where you would have different carriages for different personalities. I mean, it's conceivable, but I don't know about any research or data on that.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
In a normal intact person, whatever normal is,
Right.
you have this sprawling network of maps. There's just dozens and of maps, of body maps. There's also auditory maps and visual maps and so on. But these maps are very labile, if you will. They're very slippery. They're very morphable. And then you have beliefs, and you have neurochemistry, and you have a lot of factors coming in and impacting the brain. It's so when people would have multiple personalities, which they do, and they can switch voices, they can switch personalities. I don't know if that's so much of a body map issue as
But
it is.
it does change the way they sit. It does change the way they physically feel. I think that's an interesting future experiment in a lab and some of these scientists with whom you've already worked, for example, Sandy in at the University of California, San Diego, where you might, you know, when you're going between, if you had somebody who had multiple personality disorder that was willing to do this, and to map the way the body, the way the brain is reacting to these different body maps as they go in between these different personalities.
Well, their brains, they would have different movements and behaviors, so they would have more than one set of movement maps. Say that they would walk one way when they were in one personality and walk a different way in a different personality. That would imply that they had different motor repertoires for both walking patterns.
Yeah, I wonder whether the answer to Karen's question is ultimately an infinite number of body maps. However many body maps we really need, since we're only using, 15% of the brain anyway, that there's a lot of room in there to add more body maps.
No. You use all your brain. That's not true.
Oh, okay. Really? So that, when did that become not true? I've heard that so many times in science class growing up.
You use all your brain. I don't know where that came from.
I'm very curious,
somewhere that it was, people say only use 10% or so. It's not true. You use all of it.
Okay, good to know. I guess I was hoping that I'd have room for expansion, but I guess that's it. I've already used it up already.
Well,
I've used all my
maps can change
to look at it,
and get bigger with use, and they can atrophy with disuse.
Okay, west of the Rockies, Thomas is in Montana on Coast to Coast AM for Sandy and for Matthew Blakeslee. Go ahead, Thomas.
Yeah, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question. There's a couple times where I like wake up and I couldn't move, but I couldn't talk either. I could see everything around me, but I was wondering what that'd be caused from, like
sleep paralysis.
Yeah, but is that harmful or?
Yeah, I actually wondered about that when I was thinking about sleep paralysis while I was reading your book, but I don't remember you ever talking about it.
Yeah, sleep paralysis is in there. Yeah,
and is it okay?
It's a state that can be you can feel like there's somebody pressing on your chest, and these are sort of these out-of-body, dissociated experiences where your body is paralyzed. It's normally paralyzed when you're sleeping. There's an area of your brainstem that literally paralyzes your body so that you won't act out your dreams. And when you're in non-REM sleep, you're not paralyzed, but when you're in REM sleep, you are paralyzed. And when you come out of sleep, it's a very common experience to have this sense of sometimes you can't move your body, or some people will feel their bodies on the floor, and it happens all the time. It's quite normal, and it's a dissociated body map state.
Well, so what happens to the body map? Does your body map only become the size of your head?
No. I don't think it's a matter of size of your head. You're getting this you're coming to consciousness, and you're feeling like you should be able to move, and you can't move because it's more of a cholinergic state. It's a paralytic state. So it's more of a neurochemical state. So it's not the map is just shrunk or anything like that. It's just offline.
Okay, let's go to wildcard line. Lewis is in Las Vegas. Coast to Coast AM for the Blakeslees. Go ahead, Lewis.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Ian.
Sure.
Good morning, Sandy and Matthew. The question I had, Sandy has mentioned the wobble board, and Ian, you had mentioned about like rebooting, maybe, redoing this thing that's established in your mind's eye or in your mind's map. And Matthew had mentioned how when somebody loses weight, that their personal view tends to trump what the reality is. It takes a while for the mind to catch up with that. So it seems like belief is the trump card here. What I was wondering about is if either one of you, if you did any work in the area of the nocebo as opposed to the placebo, that would be the opposite, and also in the area of tones, the coherence of what tones, can put you in a coherent mind state so that you can, access or organize your mind and try to reach a goal. I was wondering if you did any work in that area, and if you can shed any light on how to, considering the nocebo effect, If you can shed any light on how to possibly access the mind map and reset it again.
All right, there you go.
Hey, Matt, you want to take a turn?
Well, I don't know anything about the tone part of the question.
That's interesting, though, about a vibratory tone and, like, how a vibration in a tone or in an audio response might trigger
You have an auditory map, and certainly tones could be very calming. I don't know whether they would reset anything. I don't know any research, but I do know about nocebos and
placebos. Talk about placebos, and nocebos would be an extension of that.
Yeah, those beliefs are very, very powerful. It's the most powerful medicine known, are placebos.
It can be.
And these are, you know, top-down beliefs. And what I mean by top-down is that rather than having things percolate up through your nervous system like vision and hearing and touch, your beliefs and your expectations are really create your reality most of the time, all the time, actually. That's how the brain works, by expectation. And so if you think something's going to harm you or you think something's going to heal you, very often it will.
But there are times when it won't. And so science at some point then hasn't been able to explain why, even when the belief is there, the will is there, and the same action had taken place that had worked before doesn't work anymore. There's something that goes on there. There's a disconnect that happens between will, willingness, and then past experience where it just doesn't work. And we don't know why, right?
Let's say you have headache or some sort of, you know, fairly benign health problem or even chronic back pain or something like that. Placebos are extremely successful in treating those kinds of disorders. Those are sort of what they call somatoform disorders, body states where your body's uncomfortable because it's out of balance for whatever reason. But they don't work for infectious diseases, for cancers, for things that are that really are overwhelming the system, for sort of hardcore diseases, if you will.
Yeah.
Then a belief's not going to help you.
Okay. How about this, though? Do body maps include internal organs?
Yes.
They do. You have a very special body mapping system for your innards, for your viscera, for your giblets. This map is in an area of your brain, it's folded deep inside, so it's been pretty hard to access and study until recently with imaging techniques. It's called the insula, and this is a very interesting area. You've got these very highly detailed maps in there of your heart, your lungs, your gut, and these originally evolved for maintaining what's called homeostasis, that's internal balance for things like satiety, hunger, thermoregulation, that sort of thing. But in humans, in particular, among all animals, we've really beefed up this map, and we've applied it in sort of a new direction, and that's for social emotions. So you're using your bodily states for a lot of your nuanced, complex, you know, uniquely human emotions. That's a very interesting aspect of that map.
Okay, wildcard line. John is in California on Coast to Coast AM for Sandy and Matthew Blakeslee. The body has a mind of its own. John?
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Wonderful, thank you. Go ahead.
Direct question. Very interested in the healing, let's say, of a chronic back area. And how the body mapping altering that might improve that state.
Well, pain is really, really fascinating. And it's so let's say you injured your back. Let's say you just pulled a muscle. And then it should heal up and the pain would last for a few days or a few weeks even, and then the pain goes away after the muscle's healed. But for many instances, there's chronic unrelenting pain, and when they examine your back or they examine whatever part of your body hurts, they can't find anything wrong with it. That's because the representation of that pain is in what Matt was just talking about. It's in the insula. It's the pain is being sensed in the brain tissue in the insula, and it sets up this kind of chronic activation. So anything you do to your periphery, your back or your arm or whatever hurts, is not gonna affect the pain in your brain. You're gonna have to get to it a different way.
Yeah, the pain can be learned in your brain and remain there even after the
peripheral
trauma has
healed. There is a new, a very new technique called functional MRI feedback, and they're using this for chronic pain, and they're using this now for craving states. They're using it for cigarette addiction and drug addiction, and they're also using it for psychopaths. So the way it works is you get into a scanner, and they put up a little virtual reality picture of a flame, and they have an image, real-time image of your insula, which is activating to the pain. You're feeling it's activating, you know, it's kind of there's more blood flow to it because there's the pain is activated. So then you look at this flame, and they tell you to try to quench it any way you can. You can think about snowflakes. You can think about a little man walking across your back and throwing ice water on it, whatever. But by dampening the image of the flame, which is actually correlated to the real activity of your insula, you can dampen the pain, and you can actually reduce the pain substantially.
Well, I hope that helps, Lawrence. I've experienced chronic back pain myself only briefly, and I know how just distracting that can be, and how your whole, the epicenter of your life just switches as a result. And I wish you peace with that. I hope you're getting all sorts of good help and good advice. Let's go ahead and get to, that was John in California. Sorry, Lawrence, Wildcard Line, Long Beach, California, on Coast to Coast AM. Lawrence?
I want to thank you first for steering the ship so greatly. I wanted to say I have a back and neck injury, a lot of what she just went over, but I was also toxically exposed to SO2 gas out at the oil refinery. I have this tingling sensation at my fingertips that I can project onto someone's face if I lightly brush their face on their arm.
I mean, where the other person can feel the tingle from your hand?
Yes. And now to top it, the kicker is you can feel it on my arm, and it feels like a buzzing of a bee. Hmm. I can even short it by touching one arm to the other, and it shorts it out.
Wow.
Wow.
I don't doubt a word of that. I don't doubt one word of that. I've
seen every neurologist in the South Bay, even a doctor who treated Christopher Reeves had no explanation for it. I'm still suffering from chronic pain, and acupuncture helps tremendously.
We didn't talk about acupuncture, and I think this is a good time to do that. So hang on, Lawrence. Why don't you listen for your answer off the air, and then we'll get back to that with the Blakesleys. I hope that whatever can be done is being done, and I hope that if you can feel better, you will experience that in your lifetime. And I understand you're up against a big challenge, but we're with you, buddy. And I'd love to get Sandy and Matthew on that then coming up after the break. In terms of what is it that they would, how do they look at something like that, where he could touch somebody else's face and that other person can feel the tingle, and that somebody else touches his arm and they can feel like a buzzing. I know it may not be body maps, but it's just really cool. So we'll see what two science writers have to say about that, and get your questions and comments coming up next too. The Body Has a Mind of Its Own on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Again, I put on my blog at coasttocoastam.com. I put on my blog there a link to a website which is mentioned in the book. It's kind of a complicated website, so it made it difficult to give the address out over the air. So it's just easier this way. So I wrote it and I pasted it on my blog. Go take a look, coasttocoastam.com. It'll link you there to a website where you can see a test they did on and as pertains to body mapping, in a way, to the different types of maps as they overlay in your brain. And you can go take that simple test or experience that unique phenomenon at coasttocoastam.com. Just click onto my blog and it'll take you to the link from there. And just might be fun to try that. You might even want to send that over to other people just so they could experience that for themselves. And then we'll get to everybody else's questions coming up next. Lots of folks standing by. We're not done yet. We're talking about the body maps, the maps of the brain, and how many of them exist, what effect they have on our bodies, and some of the things that the body maps now, the more research we do on them, will finally explain coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Let's get back to the phones with Kenneth on Coast to Coast AM for the Blakeslees, Sandy and Matthew, co-authors of The Body Has a Mind of Its Own. Kenneth?
Listening to your show, this is incredible. I've been writing down a few things and make some comments about the body maps. Then the healing touch, kind of like when I think of that, I was thinking of Rasputin when he was healing the Tsarevich's of hemophilia. And you guys were talking about the touch and feeling like a magnetic sense. Well, there's a device called the self-controlled inertoneuroadaptive regulation system, right? The Russian Space Agency has been working on this for a while, and it says that this creates that same feeling across your skin of that magnetic feeling. Also, I heard somebody mention something about triangles, and I think, well, naturally that goes back as far as Archimedes. Virtual reality falls into artificial intelligence. As brain mapping the brain right now, Berlin at the Bernstein Center for Computational Neuroscience, they're working on an MRI that reads minds, or so they claim. And it's kind of like, wow, you know, I when it comes to deja vu, it really feels like I feel like I've been experiencing some deja vu,
Physical experience as opposed to just an auditory one.
Well, it's auditory, it's physical. The sensations that y'all have been talking about as far as the magnetic, the healing touch and such, it's like it's all there. You know, it's like when you're during meditation, it's like when you can complete the circuit when you're sitting down and you've got, say, your forefinger and your thumb connected together. Each finger is a receptor, and it completes a circuit. If you look at who is this? For instance, in Peru, they have the geoglyphs, right? A lot of people don't understand what the geoglyphs are, but if you look at the patterns, they believe, oh, aliens or something like this, or the world created this. Well, like, no, that's not aliens. That's man. They took a lot of time carving that into the earth, and it's almost like, well, something was being premeditated.
Well, there's a lot there, so let's go ahead and have our guests talk about anything in what Kenneth said there, where they can hook into that. Go ahead, Sandy or Matthew, anything in there?
Well, you know, you can't say everything is body maps. the brain is, does just about everything, but at least, you know, it creates our world. But I don't know about triangles and the MRI thing about reading minds.
That's very interesting.
I do know about that work, and it's very doubtful that they're really reading minds. They're not reading intentions. They can tell whether you're thinking of a triangle or something, but that's not very difficult because they're just looking at the activation in the primary visual cortex. But they're not really reading minds the way that we normally think.
In a more science fictiony sense, that would be.
Yeah, but that's just where it is now. If they already have a machine that can read, if I'm looking at a triangle, but the machine doesn't see me looking at the triangle, but the machine can detect that my brain is saying triangle, that's pretty darn cool in and of itself.
Very interesting.
I think it's very simplistic. It's actually very rudimentary. It doesn't tell you any of your beliefs or your deeper thoughts. It's an object that you're looking at.
Well, not yet, but... But that's a great start to be able to say what I'm looking to see without being able to see it, just by reading my brain waves, able to read what it is I'm looking at. That's a cool start toward a more sophisticated way of being able to read a mind with a machine.
Well, the trouble is that the code, let's call it a code, let's say you have a belief that that you hate chocolate or something like that, which would be, you couldn't really have a picture of that in like a triangle in your mind. We don't know how the brain encodes those kinds of complex stimuli or the complex beliefs. There's no way that you could at this point, and maybe never, decode that through these functional imaging type machines. Maybe something else further way down the road, but that particular avenue, I don't think anybody thinks it's going to go into mind reading.
All right. East of the Rockies, John is in Houston on Coast to Coast AM for the Blakeslees.
Good morning. How you doing?
Go ahead, John.
Okay. My question is, I'm a vision impaired person. I've been having some problems with my vision, and it's come cloudy. I had glaucoma. If you lose your vision, can it be restored?
Well, glaucoma, it could be treated. Well, you know, it's interesting. That's a very interesting question. The usual answer to that would be no, unless there's some way to sort of redrive the map, the visual map, the plasticity in your visual cortex. And I think there are cases of people having been deprived of vision and then getting it back later, but there's only a few case studies like that. So, and with glaucoma, unless they could find a way to reverse it, and then there might be exercises to regain it, but I don't know of any right now that any way to do that right now.
So there are no whole eye transplants?
No.
Okay. I wonder whether that someday. Thank you, John. I'm sorry to understand that's what you're going through. That's interesting to me. How some parts of the human body can be transplanted and others can't.
Right. Well, here's an example. There's a wonderful device that you can put on your tongue, and it's like a little strip of plastic, and it's got nodes on it. And if you're blind, they put a camera on your head, and they're taking pictures of the world, and then they take the rasters or the dots, you know, from the camera. They can play that on your tongue, and your tongue will see. Now, it's
what?
A rudimentary sight. You can sort of tell that where there's trees and curbs, and you can tell where there's a person. You
really?
An exit sign.
Yeah, sort of creates a picture on your tongue.
We're using these now. And it's
totally
sort of
feels kind of like champagne bubbles.
Navy SEALs divers will use it for seeing where they are when they'll put the thing on their tongue, and they'll have a little balance bubble that will tell them which way they're swimming. Whether they're, you know, upright or not, you can if you lose your sense of balance, they can restore it on your tongue. So your brain, when it gets information, it will it can substitute one sense for another very, very easily, and that's a whole new area of exploration.
Fascinating, Matthew. Did you have something you wanted to add on that? Nope.
Oh, no, she did a pretty good job on that one.
Okay,
we do, yeah.
It sounds like, to me, I'm almost reptilian, to be able to see with one's tongue, to sort of taste the air or be able to understand where things are spatially using a tongue.
Yeah, you have a lot of sensors on your tongue. It's a very good, it's like your fingertips. Your fingertips have a lot of acuity. There's a lot of touch receptors there. And the tongue has also lots of receptors, so it can just be used as a substitute, and it's working.
West of the Rockies, Dale is in Las Vegas on Coast to Coast AM for the Blakeslees. Dale?
Hi. You were touching on a thing earlier I thought was incredibly accurate and interesting. I spent my whole life in aerospace and aviation, and the common denominator with most of the top pilots that have ever lived, they all write about, you know, it's very inside stuff, but they expand their mind to include the whole airplane. They become the airplane in a way.
That's right. Sometimes they leave the airplane.
They what?
I've talked to pilots where they can also, a very monotonous, long flight, they'll get an out-of-body experience.
I didn't know about that. Yeah, anyway, I wanted to tell you, the best pilot, I think, as far as feeling the airplane and knowing where the wingtips are at and what it's doing, the momentum, the energy, John Travolta amazed the aviation world. His personal airplane was a Boeing 707. And he was up in the air. He managed to lose all four engines at once, and became a glider. Well, I've talked to a lot of airline pilots, and they all say that they don't even train for that. They've never imagined it. But John Travolta was ready for it, managed to land it safely.
Oh.
And then to, you know, everybody...
That's a big honking plane to be landing like a glider, too. I mean, that's just huge.
What?
That's a big honking plane to be landing like a glider.
I know, but it's a wonderful glider. The thing, actually, if you look at it, you know, from a mental point of view where you've spent a lot of time flying airplanes, that thing is a very good glider. John Travolta knew it. He did it a second time. He lost all his engines again and did it twice. Well, that means it's no coincidence.
And that means I'm never going to fly with him.
Well,
that happened to him twice.
Take off twice and not have it checked out like that.
But you
do a walk around to get a feel of the plane. Everything has got to look right. Everything. If you see odd angles or lines that aren't right, if you get a feeling there's something wrong, that's why you do a walk around. Because once you're in the air, then your mind plays that back, and you have an idea if things go wrong, what to do. For instance, the B-17 during World War II could get entire sections shot away, part of the tail's gone, engine on fire. But the plane had so much wing and so much tail that you could lose part and you're okay. But then you take a plane like the V-22 Osprey, where you have two massive propellers at the end of the wings. If you lose one of those, it's going to turn into a little pinwheel real quick.
Right.
And you're not going to survive.
Not a happy kind of helicopter.
No, and that's why the military's had problems with it. As long as everything works, you're okay. But
right.
If things go wrong, you don't have a whole lot of options.
Now, that's an interesting aeronautically, that's an interesting discussion about designing a plane so that they could be symbiotically in tune with a human flying it. And so I wonder whether there are lessons to learn from that they might intentionally take to the drawing board to get away from a plane that, like this Osprey, that would seem to work against the intuitivity of the pilot.
That's a good point, yeah. Engineers are cognizant of this, you know, trying to interface with the body's and the brain's somatic intelligence, you know, not just giving controls that are at a very distant remove, but, you know, giving people lots of somatic feedback, multiple channels, and that will help them to pick up the knack and you know, operate the machine with skill. It's also interesting, the caller saying that a lot of the best pilots he's known just seem to really, you know, talk about becoming one with the airplane and, you know, becoming sort of... The sharing of that in their body space seems to almost be rising to the level of conscious awareness. I guess these people are just talented at merging their maps with these large machines around them, kind of like the earlier caller who used to pace out every new bus she would drive, and that
right.
would give her an instant sense of how her extended body was going to drive.
Any work that you all did with pilots who are aware of anything pertaining to body mapping and these larger spaces that we attach to ourselves when we're in them, where the pilot has a can't get a sensation from a simulator, where a simulator doesn't have the wings and the tail, and obviously, and you're just kind of in a different place. I wonder how that, what the mind does there. Maybe just the same sort of thing, just absorbs the simulator, but without wings and a tail, you're sort of processing that information without actually feeling it.
Right. Well, you'd have the simulator would just be visual, I would think, and you wouldn't have the feeling of gravity, weight, the vibration. There's a lot of sensory
rumbling, vibration,
when you're
all that kind of thing.
Flying in the
valuable
air.
Information.
And a
right.
simulator is just. It's a very poor representation of, but it's good for training, but it wouldn't give you that whole body sense.
Let's go to probably our last call, wildcard line. Chad is in Kentucky on Coast to Coast AM for the Blakesleys, Sandy and Matt, co-authors of The Body Has a Mind of Its Own. We're talking about body mapping. Chad?
Hey, it's a pleasure to speak with my favorite night watchman. I'm one, too.
Oh, good. Be safe out there.
Just a real quick aside, when they were talking about the planes, maybe they could, like, attach their tongue somehow to the plane, and that bring it only means they're air lingers.
Well, they've done
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, they must be working on that.
The sensory substitution work, they've put the same kind of sensors across the chest of the pilots so that, you know, pilots will very often, if they lose the horizon, this is what happened to John Kennedy. He went down in the water, you know, because
right.
he just lost the horizon, and around dusk, you can get extremely confused. So they can put a kind of band of sensors across the person's chest, along with a like a level, just a carpenter's level, and you can actually feel with your body where
like
you are.
Like a horizon gauge.
And you won't crash.
Awesome. I just had a real quick question. It's going to sound a little bizarre, but if I tickle one, the arch of one of my feet, I can feel it on the other foot. Would that be the body mapping maybe a wire crossed or something?
Sounds like.
It could be, yeah.
I mean, I don't
you know. You have a map of your body on the outside of your brain.
Sensation. It's just kind of bizarre.
Well, there are direct connections that go between corresponding body parts.
Okay. So it might literally be like a crossed wire somewhere in my noggin.
It's feasible. It's quite feasible as far as I can tell. I mean, you know, you want your hands and your feet and your knees to be able to share information, you know, across the midline so that they can better talk to each other and contribute to your understanding of how you're moving and, you know, execute your intentions and that sort of thing. So,
well, you know, we've talked about body mapping from a variety of different ways, and some ways which aren't body mapping, as Sandy said, where they just, it seems like they should be, but it's not. So was there anything in particular in your research that you wanted to mention tonight that we hadn't gotten to yet?
Yeah, because I know... I wanted to say one thing about chronic pain, because we're not dispensing any medical advice at all, but pain is really interesting in terms of these body maps, because pain is, there's a lot of misunderstanding about pain, and it really, central pain or chronic pain is very often represented in the brain, and what you have, and it's that's where it is. You're going to have to drive plasticity or change the sort of the balance of the body, the homeostatic balance, they call it, and there's this wonderful new treatment, again, from Ramachandran, who's just genius. It's called. There's a thing called chronic central pain. It's after a stroke to the thalamus. It's this burning, horrible, just killer pain. And Rama's now treating it. He's just published this with ice water in the ear, and the ice water hits the vestibular system, like we talked about earlier, you know, for mapping, and it reduces the chronic pain from post-thalamic stroke, which is just amazing. So a lot of these body maps and a lot of these pain syndromes are going to have treatments, and they're going to be sometimes as easy as ice water in the ear.
You got to like that. Very good. Thank
yeah,
you so much.
Cool.
Sandy and Matthew, the body has a mind of its own. Many things we didn't get to, all good, worth reading. And thank you so much for being here. And for everybody, too, we're just minutes away, I think, from slipping into the autumnal equinox. So if summer has been a difficult season for you, it's just about over. Here's to having better days ahead in the fall. Deus Tiamat, and I do too.